rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Our quote for the day, Albert Einstein, all of us who are concerned for peace and triumph of reason and justice must be keenly aware how small an influence reason and honest goodwill exert upon events in the political field. Coming up in today's program, Jeff Cohen is here on his new book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, that and more, and your calls, a pile of news. CEO worker to pay imbalance grows. In 2005, a CEO earned more than in one workday than the average worker earns in an entire year. In 1965, U.S. CEOs in major companies earned 24 times that of an average worker. However, by 2005, here what's the 40 years later, the average CEO is paid $10,982,000 a year, or 262 times that of the average worker. CEO pay has risen 300% since 1990. Corporate profits have increased a little more than 100% since 1990. Average worker pay increased 4%. And that's before inflation. Inflation adjusted, it's actually gone down. The minimum wage has actually decreased almost 10% if you adjust it for inflation. If we were all in the same boat and with the same rising tide as the CEOs, average workers would be earning $108,000 right now instead of $28,000, and the minimum wage would be $22.61 instead of $5.15. In particular, you see this in the defense industry. Military contractor CEOs have seen a 200% increase in their pay since 9/11, just since 9/11, whereas large company CEOs as a whole since 9/11 have only seen a 7% pay raise just during this recent period. Since September 11, the ratio of median pay for defense CEOs and pay for military and generals has increased to 23-1, whereas it was 21-1, just 3 years earlier. Body armor profiteer David Brooks, CEO of bulletproof vest maker DHB Industries, earned $70 million in 2004, a 13,000% increase over his 2001 compensation of $525,000. This is the company, by the way, that made the body armor that the Marines had to recall after it was found that it didn't work very well. By that time, however, Brooks, the CEO, had pocketed over $250 million. Alex Epstein is with us. He is a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. The Ayn Rand Institute, carrying on the thinking of Ayn Rand, the author of Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and other works, and the founder of Objectivism, which influenced heavily libertarianism, which has influenced heavily the modern conservative and neoconservative movement. This is the fountain, no pun intended on Fountainhead, the fountain of it all. And so let's go right to the source. The thinkers behind the thinkers behind the thinkers of the modern conservatives. Alex Epstein, welcome to the program.
Well, I certainly don't want to take the blame for the modern conservatives, but thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Glad to have you with us. You look at the numbers that I just laid out about CEO pay and the fact that, for example, the military-industrial complex, 200% pay raise for their CEOs since 9/11, a little differently than Franklin Roosevelt did, who said, "I will not have one war millionaire as a result of World War II."
Well, let's leave aside, we can come back to defense contractors, but that's a heavily government-influenced set of pay packages, so let's leave that aside for a second. But just CEO pay in general, there's a definite difference between us, because you seem to look at a large increase in CEO pay and treat it as, by that fact, something bad. Whereas my concern is, if the pay is set by the free market, and there are some ways in which it isn't, but I think in large part it is, there are a lot of good reasons behind it, and they're being rewarded for legitimate productive activity. So being a CEO is an extremely difficult task. It's a very, very few people have the ability. There are a lot of risks involved. There are a lot of reasons why people wouldn't want to take it on. And having the right CEO can make an incredible difference in a company's profitability. So just take someone like Jack Welch at GE and look at his compensation and look, it's just a tiny fraction.
Yeah, the guy who originated outsourcing to India. Actually.
Well, that is certainly a legitimate practice to trade with productive people in other countries.
Alex, I hate to shatter your illusions, but first of all, the CEOs, and this is, you know, well documented, the CEOs of the companies that lost the most money over the last 5 years are among those who took the greatest pay raises. I got this from the Wall Street Journal. I mean, there's a small shareholder revolt going on in a few companies, although most not. But even larger than that, you say, if, you know, the free market, there is no such thing as a free market, Alex Epstein. The market is clearly defined. There's a whole set of rules for the market that we call laws, contract laws, that define what property is and what property isn't, what, how, you know, there are, what a corporation is, how the liability of the directors, officers, and owners of the corporation is limited compared to you and I, what they can do. Corporations are run like kingdoms, not democracies, and it's not in a free market. And the compensation of CEOs is set by boards of directors, compensation committees within boards of directors that, by and large, these days are being stacked by the CEOs themselves. This has nothing to do with the free market. This is a bunch of thieves making off with a whole pile of money at the expense of the rest of us.
Okay, well, that, you raise a lot of points there, but the idea that they're thieves is just nonsense, because the essence of what a corporation is doing is they are offering a valuable product for voluntary purchase by us, and they only make money insofar as they produce a product that's worth more than it costs to produce.
I strongly disagree that it is voluntary purchase. Walmart comes into a community and wipes out all the other local businesses, it is not voluntary to shop at Walmart.
Okay, well, again, you're using violent terminology. Wipe out, all that means is that I choose to go to Walmart instead of mom and pop, because Walmart sells me stuff a lot more cheaply.
And Walmart does that because I am being forced with my tax dollars to subsidize them by paying for the health care of their minimum wage workers.
Well, then you and I can join a crusade to get rid of government-provided health care, and then we can have an equal playing field among all.
No, then we can have a whole bunch of people who are sick on the streets. We can have kids with tuberculosis standing out in front of our house with their hands out begging for food, like most of the rest of the world does.
Okay, well, it's the whole capitalist system that cures diseases like tuberculosis, but let's get back to the issue of CEO pay.
I don't recall Louis Pasteur being driven by capitalism.
I recall him living in a free country. Not one.
Louis Pasteur was driven by intellectual and scientific curiosity, and he's working at a university that was paid for with tax dollars.
Right, which is only made, and research universities are only made possible under capitalist systems where there's enough wealth in existence that people can spend time thinking and making basic.
But you would not want tax dollars paying for them, would you,
Instead of working on democratic subsistence farms where everyone is equally miserable and there's no CEOs to create incredibly efficient corporations that create all the wealth that make Pasteur possible. So again,
the corporations are not creating the wealth. The wealth is created as a consequence of people laboring. The corporations are making a profit off the labor of the people.
Well, the
workers.
No, the corporations create an efficient division of labor, which enables each individual to do what he does best, and for all to be coordinated toward an extremely productive purpose. So
it's only efficient in as much as it's producing huge salaries for the CEOs.
It's producing huge amounts of wealth, which is why the standard of living of the so-called poor people that you're talking about is higher than the standard of living of kings a couple hundred years ago.
Well, in that regard, Alex,
wealth being created.
In that regard, Alex, you know, there are some parallels between your thinking and mine. We're both neither one of us are opposed to capitalism. However, you're an advocate of absolutely unregulated capitalism, and I'm an advocate of regulated capitalism, of the kind of capitalism that we've had in the United States since 1935, by and large, and that we had during the first 30 or 40 years of this country, or 50 years of this country, up until the Civil War. And I think that's where we part company. But, again, there is no free market.
Well, yes, by freedom, I mean the absence of the initiation of force. So you regard corporations and contracts as somehow unfree. But they're...
That's right, because if you violate them, they can put you in jail.
What's that?
If you and I have a contract to do something and you fail to fulfill that contract, and I can demonstrate that your failure to do that had some malevolent intent, I can have you put in jail.
Yeah, or I can be liable.
That's the use of force. That's the
use of force. But this is an arrangement, right? But a breach of contract in many ways is like taking something. So if we agree that I'm going to pay you $50,000 to host a radio show, and I just completely break that promise, I am liable to you. I am harming you physically.
That's right, and I can initiate force against you. And all of that is paid for by...
It's retaliation.
Well, whatever you want to call it, all of it is paid for by we the people, by the taxpayers. That substrate of courts and laws and jails, all of that is the commons that we collectively pay for and that the corporations are using so that the CEOs can become billionaires.
The corporations are using it to protect their rights in the same way that we the people pay for laws so that someone can't bash me over the head with a baseball bat. It's protecting their freedom of contract. It's my freedom to get together with someone else and start a new corporation and hire people and sell it to people voluntarily.
So you really think that it is possible? I understand. So you really think it's possible that somebody can be literally worth 10,000 times more than another person in terms of their labor?
In terms of their productive ability, they can be worth a million times as much. Some people produce nothing. Some people are unbelievably productive.
Okay. Alex Epstein, AyanRand.org, if you want to read all about it. Stop meddling with executive pay, the article. Thanks, Alex.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Forces of the world unite, let us save the day. Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay. We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard and we too sometimes need to paint our homes. The pressures are incredible and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti and now we have to move from there. They're clamoring for more than a dollar a day from Malaysia to Mexico. At that rate, pretty soon, there'll be no place for us to go.
Indeed.
Bosses of the world unite. Don't just sit there, fight, fight, fight.
Bosses of the world unite! Don't just sit there, fight, fight, fight. Welcome back to The Pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program, 22 minutes past the hour. Alex really lays out the worldview of these folks who believe in laissez-faire economics or laissez-faire capitalism. And again, I am not opposed to capitalism. I guess I am a capitalist. I've started 7 businesses. Some of them have done very well over the years. I own a business right now which owns this radio show, a corporation. I'm not opposed to the capitalist system. However, that said, when capitalism is absolutely unregulated, if you look over the history of the human race, if you look back, or not the human race, of what we call Western civilization, because there are many societies, we call them Aboriginal or Indigenous societies, but there are, and up until 200 years ago, they were the majority of humans on the Earth. As much as 150 years ago, they were half the humans on Earth. Today, they're about 5%. But if you look at Aboriginal Indigenous societies, people who have had thousands, tens of thousands of years of trial and error to work out how to live together, they tend to be egalitarian and democratic, functionally. But if you look at the history of Western civilization going all the way back 7,000 years to the Epic of Gilgamesh, to Gilgamesh rise, 7,000 years ago in Uruk, the first major city in history that we know of, and the Epic of Gilgamesh, the first written story that we know of, which, by the way, included the story of a good and decent man who was told by one of the gods that he should build an ark with two of each of the animals in it. This was 2,000 years before the Bible was written. The first story of downwind siltation and desertification, saltation, and downwind desertification, because they cut down the forests of Lebanon to build this mighty city, and because the barley fields were irrigated in a way that caused salt to build up over time and rendered them, they thought the gods were punishing them. 200-300 years down the road, suddenly they couldn't grow their barley anymore. The salt level had risen in the ground to the point where it wouldn't support barley. But that's 7,000 years ago. There are pottery shards documenting contracts. They had contract law in ancient Sumeria. In fact, a lot of this was found in one of the ancient site of the ancient city of Uruk, which our military accidentally 3 years ago made, paved over, crushing thousands of ancient artifacts paved over and turned into an Air Force runway. So, but that's what happens. What happens is when you have absolutely unregulated capitalism, you end up with a very small ruling elite, a very small mercantile class, basically the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the shopkeepers, and a very large class of the working poor. And if you want to have a middle class, which I really believe is essential to democracy, if you want to have a middle class, you must have regulated capitalism. I would never want the government to be making my shoes or my clothes or my computer or my TV or anything else. But I do think that the playing field on which the game of business is played, which is created by we the people, we create contract law. We create the laws that establish what business is. We create the court system and we pay for the court system. We create the stable currency and we pay for the stable currency. We the people who created this whole infrastructure on which and in which business operates, we should be able to say, you know, if you're going to play the game of business, that's great, but you're going to have to do it in a way that's respectful of we the people and allows a middle class to emerge. Because traditionally, in absent of that involvement of government in the marketplace, as Franklin Roosevelt taught us, absent of that, you will end up with no middle class. And without a middle class, you can't have a democracy. So we're going to do a progressive pop quiz here today. Time now for our progressive pop quiz. I'm going to give away a copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So right now, time for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question, since all CEO pay has risen 200% since 9/11, the average CEO pay has risen 200% since 9/11, just since 9/11, in what industry? Just in one industry has this happened. See, average CEO pay has gone up 7% since 9/11. But in one industry, average CEO pay has gone up 200%. What is that industry? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-TOM, 440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So the answer to that will be coming up after the break. And, of course, I already gave you the answer a little earlier on if you were paying careful attention. 1-866-440-8466 to be participating in our progressive pop quiz. 27 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds
that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand.
You cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds.
Wake up and shake it up, America.
South from east to west, from sea to shining sea.
Our government gives a fight for we the people who can ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Listener-supported radio. Yes, it is, in fact, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, supported by you, our listeners, when you support our sponsors. In particular, the local sponsors you hear on your local radio program, and our national sponsors as well. Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. 1-800-425-2532. All of their coffees, fair trade and organically grown. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, their website. The Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. 1-888-ECO-WINE, ECOWINE.com, their website. And Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS for information. And smalldog.com, of course, their website. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Once again, our question was, what industry has seen a 200% average increase in the pay of its CEOs just since 9/11? While all other American industries on average have gone up, CEO wages have gone up about 7% since 9/11, This industry has seen a 200% increase in CEO salary increases. It's the defense industry. And congratulations to Dan Williams of Springfield, Massachusetts, for you the answer. There you go. Congratulations. Good on you, Dan. And in our progressive pop quiz here on the Tom Hartman radio program. On this day in history in 1873, this from History Channel, history.com, the Panic of 1873, the headline, Robber Barons Cause Panic. It's one of the worst financial crises in the nation's history. It stretched on for 5 years, closing banks and deflating markets, as well as damaging people's faith in the future of the nation. This is about the time that, or out of this, was the time, you know, in the early 1880s, that came the Wobblies, that came the progressive movement, that came the populist movement, that came the stuff that fueled Teddy Roosevelt, and that became the reforms of Franklin Roosevelt, a generation, two generations after this, three generations after this, a generation after Teddy. The Depression of 1873 began on September 18th with the surprising collapse of Jay Cook and Company, one of the country's most reputable brokerage houses. Jay Cook's downfall, again, this from history.com, due mainly to an ill-fated decision to fund a second transcontinental railroad line, was less a smoking gun than a highly visible symptom of America's fiscal instability. Why? No government regulation. Essentially, we had absolute laissez-faire capitalism. And this was the era of the robber baron. By 1900, the average income in the United States, the average family income, $9,700 in today's dollars. After 12 years of unchecked expansion, the economy was bloated from inflation and excess speculation when the panic hit with devastating results. Along with Jay Cook, 37 banks and two brokerage houses closed their doors on this day in 1873. In the ensuing days, the losses increased. The New York Stock Exchange was forced to shut down for more than a week. With the situation growing dire, the Secretary of the Treasury decided to infuse the economy with $26 million worth of paper money, which did not subside the panic, and the economy continued its slump through the end of the decade, right up until the 1800s. Tough times. Tough times. And that's, you know, could we be here again? We could be. For example, on this day in 1789, that was the year the Constitution was ratified. It was also the year that the United States government took out its first loan. On September 18th, 1789, the nation's finances something of a mess. Under the supervision of newly appointed Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, the government took a little over a year to pay back its first loan of $191,608. $191,608. That was our first loan. And we paid it off in a year. Right now, the U.S. debt stands at $8,362,362,407.33, or $27,929.34 for every person. In other words, if a child is born in the United States right now, that child is born with a $27,929 debt. The national debt share for the breadwinner of a family of four, $111,717. That's how much debt this government has run up in your and my name, and the vast majority of it by two men, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, as part of their so-called starve the beast strategy. If they could just, you know, if they can just make it so, run the government into bankruptcy, make it so exhausted, so out of money that there's no money to pay for social programs. And then we can stop that socialism, that nasty socialism. I mean, it's really mind-boggling when you think about it. The amount of money that we are spending this year, just this year, the amount of money that we're spending on the debt, on the interest, excuse me, on that $8 trillion debt, because we do have to pay interest on it, is going to be over $300 billion. $300 billion. Is enough to provide full four-year scholarships at public universities to over 15 million children. Free. It's enough to pay for 41 million children to attend Head Start. It's enough to pay for 5 million new teachers, 5,468,000 new school public school teachers for an entire year. That $300 billion that we're paying in interest on the national debt, which, by the way, is about the same amount of money as we're spending in Iraq, is enough to build 2,841,000 housing units for low-income housing. I mean, it's just mind-boggling what we could be doing with that that we're not. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Stan in Otterdale, Minnesota. Hey, Stan, welcome to the program.
Oh, Tom, it's an honor to speak to you, and I just can't tell you how much I learned from your program, and I passed it on to my 18-year-old son who learns a lot from you, and it's just a terrific honor to...
Well, thank you, Stan. Stan, are you in the listening area of KTNF in Minneapolis?
Actually, Tom, I'm over the road truck driver. I'm in between Atlanta and Augusta, Georgia right now.
Oh, okay.
Now.
So you're listening on Sirius Satellite. The reason I mention that is because we're going live today. Not live. Three stations are picking up the show. They're all time delaying it and running it later in the evening. But KTNF in Minneapolis, Minnesota, KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, and KQKE, the Quake in San Francisco. And I want to welcome the listeners to those three stations. Stan, your comment or question or whatever you were going to say here.
Well, I tuned in late.
We just lost Stan. Holy cow. The perils of calling on a cell phone. You might want to call it again, Stan. We'll put you back on the air. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Charles in Hillsborough, Ohio. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, guys. I just want to talk about what we can do to keep big business out of our government.
The solution is political. I mean, the bottom line is the rules of the game of business are created. And I'm going to, Charles, I'm sorry, I'm going to drop your call because you've got all that noise there in the background that's just, eating it up. But the bottom line is that the rules of the game of business are created at the level of the House of Representatives and the Senate and the presidency. I mean, it's really that simple. There is no free market. There is the substrate of a market. How do you define... You know what? Let's say you and I had an agreement that you'd mow my lawn, I'd wash your car. I mean, you'd think that that's the free market, right? That's as simple as it gets. But what happens if you mow my lawn and I don't wash your car? What are you going to do? Well, you have to have a court to sue me in. I mean, if you really wanted to be able to enforce it. Or what if I wrecked your car instead of washing it? There have to be laws that define what property is. There has to be a court system to be able to adjudicate those laws. There have to be jails for people who don't play by the rules of the game. The Ken Lays of the world, assuming the Bushies don't get to them first once they start negotiating with prosecutors for plea bargains. conspiracy theory number 712. All of that stuff is necessary in order to do business. And the rules of the game have been re-rigged since Ronald Reagan came into office, since the so-called Reagan Revolution. The rules of the game have been re-rigged in order to make the United States, basically to say, we're going to have a two-class system here. If you're the wealthy and the powerful, there's one set of rules for you, and if you're the average working stiff, there's another set of the rules. It's most obvious in Bush's most recent tax policy. In 2 years ago, Bush's last tax cut changed the rules of taxation, so we have now a two-class system for taxes. If you earn your living by the sweat of your brow or the sweat of your body, with your mind or your mind or your body, if you earn a paycheck, you pay a maximum 30-some-odd income tax rate, 33%, 34%, whatever it is. You pay that is your maximum income tax rate you pay. And if you're making $90,000 or less, 100% of your income is taxed for Social Security purposes. If you earn your living, on the other hand, sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, in other words, if you're an investor and you receive your money from passive income, the most tax income tax you will pay, the maximum, the highest income tax rate for people who earn for the Paris Hiltons of the world, the maximum income tax rate is 15%. Period. That was Bush's contribution to our tax code. I mean, get this. And after $90,000, you don't pay one penny into the Social Security Trust Fund. On your first $1 million, not a penny. Your first $90,000, yes, you pay. And after that, not a penny. On your second million, not a penny into Social Security. Your third million, not your fifth million, your tenth million, your 50th million, your first billion, not a penny into the Social Security Trust Fund. You want to solve the problems of Social Security in one day, forever? Simply say, okay, we're going to pick up Steve Forbes' flat tax plan. And we're going to say, everybody pays Social Security tax on all of their income. That's all you'd have to do is eliminate the $90,000 cap and say millionaires and billionaires have to pay into the Social Security Fund also. It would fully fund the program forever. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
You're You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey!
Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk.
Karl Rove.
He didn't serve.
Dick Cheney.
He didn't serve.
Tom DeLay.
He didn't serve.
And George Bush was A-W-O-L.
Chicken hawk.
Republicans, line up for duty. I'm telling you, the day that they institute a draft, or the day that they start specifically sending the kids of Republicans off to Iraq, is the day the Iraq war will end. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. John in Phoenix, Arizona, where we're on the air on KPHSX. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, John?
Tom, I bought your book. I love it.
You mean Screwed?
Screwed.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if I mentioned this on the air last week. I went home after I got off the air and got a phone call from David Bruce, who's the managing editor at Hustler. He calls up and he says, "Hi, I'm the managing editor at Hustler. I understand you've got a new book out called Screwed." And my first thought was, uh-oh, but then I got it. You know, Hustler's actually a very progressive publication, say, politically speaking, so there's going to be a story, I think, about it in the next issue. Anyhow, what's up, John? You got the book, and you had a question about it? Whoop, somehow John got put on hold.
I mailed them to people, and it's a great book, but my question for you is, why is it that it's the middle class and the lower class people that have them stupid Viva Bush stickers on the...
We just lost John. That's funny. We lost a couple calls all at once there. I think we've got a problem with the board, Alex. You need to pass that along. John, my apologies. I didn't get your question. I don't know what it was. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom.
Morning. Or afternoon, as the case may be. Or even as the case may be in many parts of the country. What's up? Oh, Gary vanished, too. Holy cow. We definitely have a problem here. Amazing. Okay, normally we would be taking a whole bunch of calls here, but we've got a problem there in New York with the call screening software. Charles City, Iowa. This is the dateline of an article on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. And it gets into this whole issue, you know, or back to this whole issue of what's going on with the middle class. How is the middle class being wiped out here in the United States? The headline is U.S. debate. Guest workers, they are here now. Charles City, Iowa, the article by Joel Millman. When he's at home in Montemorelos, Mexico, Roberto Canto earns $300 a month pouring cement or concrete. $300 a week. Last month, a labor recruiter called him, promising similar work in Colorado and Iowa, paying five times as much. Within hours, Mr. Cantu, his three grown sons, and his brother were driving their white pickup truck 250 miles north of the U.S. border on the way to job sites another 700 miles away. It was the Cantu's fifth trip this year to take temporary U.S. jobs, during which they crossed, say, 18 states. The Cantus are, now these are not illegal immigrants. The Cantus are among an estimated tens of thousands of Mexicans with an unusual place in the bitter debate over immigration, writes the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to quirks in the law, they have green cards enabling them to come to the U.S. for work stints. Many, like the Cantus, who call themselves subsidos, for the Spanish verb for to rise, I would say, go back to the Latin root, maybe to substitute, because they do all the grueling jobs of pouring concrete, and it goes on. Joel Millman in the article adds, there is some evidence that the Mexicans drive down wages in the industries where they work. In 1986, the Simpson-Rodino Immigration Reform and Control Act, this was signed by Ronald Reagan, granted amnesty to 2.7 million undocumented workers, and it basically gave them a chance for a green card. That's these folks. And Midwest construction firms, including Fagan Engineering, Granite Falls, Minnesota, and T.E. Eberson Company of Hodgkins, Minnesota, and subcontractors Todd and Sargent McCormick Construction of Rockford, Minnesota, find Mexican subsidos through a loose confederation of recruiters on the Texas-Mexico border. These include Ray Maldonado, a Puerto Rican-born transplanted New Yorker, now based in the border town of Eagle Pass. 52-year-old Mr. Maldonado manages a loyal pool of Mexican workers. His vets work documents of subsidios. His vets work documents of subsidios referred by his network of scouts across northern Mexico. He also places some subsidios in permanent jobs with U.S. employers. On a recent Saturday in Laredo, Texas, Mr. Maldonado shepherded 20 workers with their belongings in tiny suitcases and plastic garbage bags into vans bound for North Dakota. He's, you know, and they just described the whole thing of he's getting these folks in, they're hopping on their, they're heading up there. Most jobs are non-union. The accommodations aren't lavish. At the best budget inn in Charles City, the five Cantus were crowded into a $30 a night room paid for by Todd and Sargent. This is the construction company. For the two-week job, workers on the day shift used the beds by night, while the late shift workers crawled in after the shift change at 7 a.m. Hotel manager Linda Webb says, I don't have the staff to change everyone's sheets. I tell each one to show courtesy to the man he's sharing with and to shower before going to bed. They go on to note, this is the Wall Street Journal. This is the wealthy talking to the wealthy. The presence of so much Mexican construction labor worries union officials in the Midwest and mountain states. Yeah, I wonder why. Union officials complain bitterly that competition from Mexico is driving down wages, and there's evidence to back them up. Robert Cantu's Pueblo pay stubs show that he earned $14 an hour for a 45-hour week and $21 for every additional hour. Pete Mustachio, business manager at Cement Mason's Local 577 in Denver, says Colorado's union pourers earn twice that, including an hourly wage of $23.40 plus health insurance and pension benefits valued at another $9 an hour. So here we already have a guest worker program in the United States, and it's already helping to wipe out the middle class. Gee, what a surprise. I mean, the bottom line here is that we have to have some control over our labor force and as well as what's, you know, being outsourced. And this guest worker program, in my opinion, is just going to further destroy the middle class in America, which is exactly what the cons want. I think the Democratic Party is making a terrible mistake by supporting it. 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Welcome back to our program. What's up with cable news? Fox News, MSNBC, CNN. Jeff Cohen sat in the catbird seat. He saw the whole thing from the inside out. He was the senior producer of the Donahue Show over at MSNBC before they pulled it on the eve of the Iraq War, even though it was the most profitable show on the entire network. He's the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, and the co-author of a whole bunch of different books, Wizards of Media Oz, The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error. And he has a new book out. It's called Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. And Jeff Cohen, welcome to the program, or welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
Great to have you here, Jeff. Your book is organized in three parts. It starts out, you know, your embedded introduction and your unembedded wrap, or sort of like how you got into it and how you got out of it, I'm assuming here. But part one, CNN, part two, Fox News, part three, MSNBC. Let's just go through these.
Yeah. Well, CNN, I was a regular guest on what was the biggest debate show at the time, Crossfire. And then I was even co-host sometimes. And when you're co-host of Crossfire back then, like in the 80s and 90s, when I was guesting and then co-hosting, it was, you know, we looked back at it as sort of a shouting match.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the time we thought it was a shouting match. Now it looks like the Oxford Debating Society, because you do 22 minutes on a serious subject. It wouldn't be like JonBenet or Runaway Brides. And, I mean, the main impact of my work at CNN as a media critic and then when I was on the air was to try to get them to include both wings of the American political spectrum. And that's not what they wanted. I mean, the first host of Crossfire was Tom Braden for about 7-8 years. He'd been a CIA official in charge of covert operations against the Western European left. He was like a centrist that makes Alan Colmes look progressive.
And he was the liberal?
Yes, he was the voice. He was every night, I'm Tom Braden from the left. And he was replaced by Michael Kinsley. Kinsley, after having been identifying himself as from the left, I'm Michael Kinsley, he was asked by Howard Kurtz, how would you describe your politics? And he said, well, I'm a wishy-washy moderate. So, and then I was tested to be his replacement, and I got into the finals, and I tell that story. But to make a long story short, and Jim Hightower has written about me in his book and my effort to become the voice of the left on CNN, you can't represent the American left on national TV every night if you're actually on the left. What they want is a corporate centrist, a backpedaler, someone who will give in to the right winger on the air with you. They want a spectrum that goes from GE to GM. And
right.
I describe the kinds of people that have represented the left on national TV over the years. Alan Colmes, Michael Kinsley, Tom Braden, Mark Shields, Alan Hunt of the Wall Street Journal. You know, their motto could be, I'm not a leftist, but I play one on TV. And that's the essence of that first third of the book.
Well, it even goes a step beyond that. Jeff Cohen, the author of Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. I have contended for some time that there is no left any longer in the United States. I actually, even just to make the point very, very visible and very vivid, I had on this program a year or two ago the president or the chairman or whatever his title is these days of the Communist Party of the United States.
Uh-huh.
There still is a CPUSA extant. I think they have 35 members. And I had him on, and I said, you know, okay, you're the real left. What do you think we should do? And he said, well, you know, we should nationalize everything. The government should own the means of production and distribution. I said, the government should be manufacturing my clothes. He was like, yeah. The government should make my TV and computer. Yeah. The government should own the trucking company that delivers. Yeah. The government should take over Walmart. Yeah. I mean, that's the left. I mean,
right.
And Joe McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover waged an unrelenting war against that left. I mean, my grandfather was an old socialist, not a communist like
yep.
the guy that I had on, but he was an old socialist. And the old socialists and the communists, they're dead. They're gone.
Yep.
There is no left in America. Instead, what we have is this vast swath of America, and I would say probably 70 to 80%. You look at, and I've had this conversation with John Zogby, and I had lunch with Paul Ray, the guy who came up with the cultural creative concept and social
yep.
scientist over the weekend in San Francisco. He was saying the same thing, that you ask the American public, where do you stand? What do you believe in? What are your values around issues like, should we have national health care? Should corporations be accountable and held responsible and have to pay or clean up if they're putting mercury into the air or arsenic into the water? Should there be a social safety net? Should there be a minimum wage that's actually a livable wage where you can actually raise a family? Should we have free or very inexpensive public education at the college level, like the University of California used to be, or like Thomas Jefferson invented the University of Virginia to be? And these basic fundamental core issues, right across the board, 70-80% of Americans say, yes, that's where I stand.
Yep.
And yet when somebody goes on national television and, you know, on one of the Sunday morning talk shows or on CNN or MSNBC or whatever and espouses any of those positions, they are portrayed as the extreme left.
Yep.
And they are not. They are the radical middle. What we have here is the middle not even being represented by and large. And then we've got a debate between the right and the Reich.
That's right. It's the right and the further right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, during the Tom Braden Pat Buchanan period on CNN's Crossfire, it was the LSD guru Timothy Leary who said, boy, when I watch Crossfire, it's like the right wing of the CIA debating the left wing of the CIA.
Yeah. Well, it literally was.
Yeah, literally. And, you know, that was his most sober observation. But you're completely right. Look, in my book, I describe the legacy of McCarthyism. Because I went to these executives, and I made exactly the point, Tom, that you made, which is, I'm not asking you to put an extremist on. I'm asking you to put someone on the air who represents millions of your viewers.
The majority of your viewers.
Who believe in Well, believe me, their whole viewership is 1 million at CNN,
yeah.
At least at that time. So, you know, at a single time. So I would say, you know, it would be not only good for democracy to have a full debate instead of the GE to GM spectrum that you've been having, but it'll boost your ratings when these people that are out there in the audience see, wow, finally someone's talking about healthcare. Finally someone's talking about how NAFTA is hurting our country.
Yeah, the majority of Americans would like to have a union job.
Of course. And again, I made these, that's what's interesting about my weird, fluky, drop into the center of corporate media, because I came with the same attitudes as you, trying to represent the majority of people, and I was talking to these executives, and frankly, they wanted to have a debate between the right and the writer.
Yeah, it's and you saw the same thing at MSNBC, and
of course.
I mean, at Fox, it's a given, but at MSNBC, the Donahue show.
Yeah, well, that was the same thing. It was, again, and what I saw at all of the channels I was at is the number one fear that they inculcate in the staff is the fear of doing anything that could get you accused of being liberal or your channel accused of being liberal. Now
there's no problem if you're accused of being conservative.
No, who cares?
That's, you can have Joe Scarborough on. You can have Tucker Carlson on. You can have, you know, who's this new guy on, the right-wing talk show host on CNN?
Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, really toxic right-wingers, no problem.
Right.
But somebody who actually represents, who is called the left, but who actually represents the majority of Americans.
Right.
No, we can't have that on television because they don't represent the majority of the corporate CEOs.
That's it, or the corporate sponsors.
Yeah, exactly. When you and I grew up, Jeff, you know, years ago, long ago and far away, most cities had a couple of newspapers,
yeah.
And there was in every major city in the United States, and in most medium-sized cities, there was a labor paper. There was a mainstream newspaper that instead of having a business section had a labor section. You know, I grew up in Michigan. It was the Detroit News,
right.
And the Detroit Free Press,
yep.
And the Detroit News had the labor section, and the Free Press had the business section, and they, you know, they competed.
Right.
All those labor sections are gone from all the newspapers all across America.
Well, Hightower writes in the foreword to my book, Jim Hightower, about that, that, you know, and the reason that, I mean, what they were worried about at CNN, just to jump back for a second, is they knew I was allied with the labor movement. They had various points of view, people that were allied with different sectors of the corporate elite, that tiny group, but I was allied with the labor movement. When I was up for it to be the co-host of Crossfire, presidents of labor unions were writing CNN and saying, finally, we would have a voice on your channel.
Which
and
is why they didn't put you on.
Yeah, that was the problem. But now, all right, so stepping forward to MSNBC and this fear.
Well, and I'm sorry, we just have about 10, 15 seconds.
Okay, all right, but I mean, there was this fear. The country was evenly divided about going to war, and they demanded, management ordered us to tilt the show to benefit those who were advocating for invading Iraq. And it was a tragedy, and I saw it from the inside.
Right. For every liberal, you had to have two conservatives.
Yep.
For Michael Moore, you had to have three.
Yep.
It's an amazing story. You can read all about it. The new book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, by Jeff Cohen. The website, cablenewsconfidential.com. Jeff, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you, as always. 16 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Here's the news, coming to you every hour on the hour. The weather's fine, but there may be a meteor shower.
And welcome back to the radio support group of By and For We, the People of the United States of America. 21 minutes past the hour. Our phones are rebooted and working now, by the way, it appears. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go by tomhartman.com, and you can participate in live conversations while the program's on the air from noon to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time, Monday through Friday. And if it's time delayed, then you're also welcome to drop into our into our message area, our blog, our chat message area, which you can also get to from tomhartman.com, where you'll find I think it's probably over 100,000 messages now posted there. A bunch of people hanging out and talking with each other. Right now, Victoria Jones is with us. She's with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their website, our capital security correspondent, our senior capital security correspondent. Hey, Victoria.
Well, yes, hey, and I think we did a good job today. He got in, yes, he got through a barricade, he did. He got up the steps and he got in, but there was only one of him.
He? What?
The man.
Tell me the story.
Well, around 8 o'clock this morning, a man driving a car crashed through a barricade near where the visitor center's being built, and then crashed through sort of another barricade, got out of his car. He was armed, by the way, and ran up the steps to the entrance to the Capitol by the rotunda, went into the entrance by the rotunda, and ran through, and then I believe he ran down to the basement.
Holy cow. Now, any idea why?
No.
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 But they got him.
Loony, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
They got him.
They got him.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of a shame. It's really a sad commentary, I think. I remember the first time I was in Washington, seriously. I mean, I've been to Washington a whole bunch of times, but the first time I played tourist with government buildings was in the late 80s. One of my books was inducted into the Smithsonian.
Cool.
Yeah, it's in fact, it's still there and on display. It's a book called Think Fast, and it won an award for contributions to technology and medicine. And so I went down to check the whole thing out, and I went over to the Capitol building, and you could just walk in, walk around, you know, walk by members of Congress's offices, and you know, look at go into the gallery and see what was going on. I was in Washington, D.C. a year or so ago for that debate with Bill Bennett and all those other conservatives over at the Heritage Foundation.
Yes.
And on C-SPAN, I think you folks helped put that thing together, as I recall.
Yes.
And I couldn't get into the Capitol building. I mean, we were meeting Bernie Sanders and John Conyers, and Bernie, you know, met me outside and had to get me through security. I mean, we can't visit our own Capitol any longer.
No, it is difficult. I mean, you can get in as a tourist, you know, under certain circumstances, but because the place is crawling with tourists, I could say that, which drives those
of
the world.
Maybe this was unique then. This was about 2 years ago,
it might have been that it was tougher then.
Yeah, post 9/11, I know there was, and pre-election. I mean, the big deal was, you know, everybody was freaking out before the election.
Right.
In 2004.
But you can't wander around on your own.
No.
No, you still cannot do that.
Yeah, which seemed like a shame. Bernie took us around in all these tunnels underneath. It's wild down there.
Oh, the tunnels are fascinating. I don't know my way around them. I just know my way to the trains. The trains, I understand.
Yeah.
Which are terribly useful, but the tunnels, it's a whole other world down there with tunnels and pipes.
Yeah. So what do you think is going to happen here with this thing with John Warner, John McCain, and... there's one other senator who are
Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham, that's right, the former JAG officer from South Carolina, who are standing up, the three veterans who are standing up to a president who went AWOL during the Vietnam War, and saying, you know, you get bad intelligence from torture, you get the best intelligence through these sophisticated techniques the CIA has developed over the last 40 years of essentially inducing the Stockholm syndrome in people, getting them on your side. You get the worst intelligence by dunking them, you know, by waterboarding them and things. So number one, we don't want to be torturing people. Number two, we don't want our people to be subject to this in the battlefield. Number three, this is a violation of the rules of war, of international law. And Bush is still pushing for this. What's going to happen?
Well, it's interesting. Now, they've been joined now by Susan Collins of Maine and probably by Olympia Snowe also. Two more Republican senators, although there are many Republicans who'd say that, you know, they're really not.
Yeah, I'm surprised Lincoln Chafee hasn't gotten in on it.
I know. Well, he needs to get reelected in November.
Yeah.
He still needs the Republican Party. So
he's laying low.
He's probably laying a little bit low, just for a little bit longer.
So, there's word of a compromise. I don't see how you can compromise on torture.
Well, this started to emerge on the Sunday shows yesterday. You had Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, coming out and just giving tiny, weeny words that would indicate wanting to work with the senators in language that we hadn't heard before. Not not compromise, nothing as strong as that, but just a tiny leaning. And you got the same thing from Senator McCain. I think it was McCain. It may have been Graham. But also indicating a leaning. And the sense I got of it, Tom, and this may just be me making this up, I got the sense that, look, they both sides realized the enemy is the Democrats. We need to be elected in November. We've got to sort this out.
The Republicans have decided, so they're going to come up with something one way or another.
That's what I think.
And then so as not to harm the Republican Party, and then after the elections they'll redo it.
Probably.
Yeah, tragically. Okay, thank you, Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Good talking to you, Victoria. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman, radio program Viagra for your brain, but don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as Bush Sr. refers to Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look at what's going on with the American occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camp. And there is blood on the rise.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq, reported by Reuters on Monday as of 1100 GMT, Dateline Baghdad, 14 bodies tortured and with bullet holes in the head were found in different districts of Baghdad on Monday, a Ministry of Interior source said. Near Kut, three border guards were killed and six wounded by a roadside bomb when they were searching that village near the Iraqi-Iranian border. In Karbala, gunmen killed four men in different parts of the holy Shiite city. In Bakaba, gunmen killed four members of a Shiite family and wounded five as they were leaving home at their homes after receiving death threats in that religiously mixed city. In Hibihib, gunmen killed two members of a Shiite family and wounded two others as they were leaving their home after receiving death threats. In Mosul, police found the bullet-riddled corpses of four women in different districts of Mosul. One of the bodies showed signs of torture. In Mosul, three civilians were wounded when a roadside bomb went off near an Iraqi army patrol. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army killed two insurgents and arrested 36 suspects during the past 24 hours. In Mosul, a man and child were wounded when several mortar rounds landed in and around a police station, and four policemen were killed when insurgents ambushed them in Mosul. Oh, there's more. And in Anbar province, the Iraqi army with Anbar province tribal leaders killed 27 insurgents during the last week. And in other developments, Dateline Basra, chanting slogans and burning a white effigy of Pope Benedict, some 150 demonstrators in the Iraqi Shiite city of Basra demanded a papal apology on Monday for comments that have offended many Muslims worldwide. Yeah, good old Benedict. You know, he used to be the guy who was in charge of the office that used to be called the Office of the Inquisition. So he put his foot in it that time. Welcome back to the program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Get to your calls and just say, I want to wrap up this topic that I started in the first hour of the program. I'd really plan on getting into it in a little more detail here, but our phones croaked, and they appear to be working now. But it's a topic that's worth really digging into, and it's a follow-on to the first hour, to the first segment, the first hour, where we had Alex on from the Ayn Rand Institute, where he was saying, well, whatever CEOs can make, that's just fine. And that is that we are very, very rapidly becoming something that resembles the historic feudal societies of Europe, China, Japan. For that matter, the Incas and the Mayans were feudal societies, where you have a small ruling class that's fabulously wealthy, and you have a small middle class that are basically the shop owners, the local shop owners, where there are any left. And then you have a very large class of very of the working poor, of people who are literally two paychecks away from losing their home, and if they get sick, losing their lives. And the two ways that countries historically maintain their middle class are both, two of several ways. There's, we can talk about tariffs on some other occasion. But basically the two, well, actually this is a piece of it right now. The two ways are by basically maintaining a relationship between the demand for labor and the amount of labor that causes the cost of labor to rise to a point where a middle class can emerge. If you have, yeah, back in 1814, the economist David Ricardo wrote a paper called On Labor, in which he just came right out and said, I mean, he was describing Victorian-era England. I mean, the economics of Victorian-era England, ultimately. Charles Dickens, in his novels, always wrote about this. His father was thrown into a debtor's prison. I mean, he certainly knew it well, that when you have absolutely unregulated laissez-faire capitalism, totally unregulated, and an unregulated economy, in quotes, I mean, keep in mind, the government creates the economy, but when it's created solely for the benefit of the corporations and the wealthy, what you get is rule by the corporations and the wealthy and a lot of poor people. And so one way that you keep jobs in a country and you keep the pay high is by protecting the industry that those jobs are in. What we did before Bill Clinton signed NAFTA and GATT, and before Ronald Reagan and Bush Sr. started pushing for permanent and normal trade relations with countries like China and other countries, which essentially did away with tariffs, is we had a tariff system in the United States. This goes back to 1787. And the tariff system in the United States, the way it worked was we said, hey, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in the United States, if you want to make that pair of shoes in Malaysia where you can make them for 10 cents worth of labor, or in Mexico where you can make them for 20 cents worth of labor, we can't stop you from doing that. That's fine. You can do that. But when you bring those shoes into the United States, if you bring them in from China where that labor is 10 cents, it's going to cost you a 90-cent tax on the import of them. And if you bring them in from Mexico where the labor is 20 cents, it's going to cost you an 80-cent tax on the import of them. So that no matter where you make that pair of shoes, it's going to cost you a dollar in labor cost when you figure the cost of labor plus the tariff. And that's the only reason that we were making shoes in the United States in the 1950s and 60s. It's the only reason in the 1940s. It's the only reason in the 1930s. It's the only reason in the 1850s. It's the only reason in the 1770s, 1780s that we were making shoes in the United States rather than in cheap labor countries, was because we protected the industry. It's the only reason we made textiles. It's the only reason we made steel. It's the only reason we made most of what we made, rather than all those manufacturing jobs going offshore, was because we protected domestic industries. And every nation in the world does this. Right now, except the United States. I mean, we've gone insane. Enough, you know, Tom Friedman with his book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, started this thing, the billionaire Tom Friedman. Started promoting this thing, and Bill Clinton bought into it like a religion. And George Bush Sr., of course, was on board right from the get-go. I mean, this goes back to Reagan. This is the Reagan Revolution. Let's throw American workers into a competitive situation with workers in China who will work for 10 cents an hour. Now, why would these guys say having a middle class is a bad thing? Why would they engage in behavior that's going to destroy a middle class by doing away with tariffs? I mean, tariffs were an important part of America. Not only did they maintain a middle class, not only did they maintain productive capacity, manufacturing capacity within the United States, they also supplied revenue to the government. 100% of the cost of operating the United States government from the founding of this country until the Civil War came from tariffs. 100%. From the Civil War to World War I, two-thirds of the total revenue that operated the United States government came from tariffs. And from World War I to World War II, it was one-third. I mean, we're talking huge amounts of money. So not only was it, not only did it maintain our domestic industries, but it also helped pay for schools and roads and hospitals and an air traffic control system and railways and all the domestic infra, police and fire and everything else. I mean, now if GM wants to sell a car in China, the Chinese, not being idiots, put a 20% import tariff on it. But if the Chinese want to sell a car in the United States, 2% import tariff. And it's going down fast. So that's one way. Number one is you protect your middle class by protecting your borders with regard to the movement of goods, of product, with a system that's referred to as tariffs. And we've done away with that. It's a dirty word. Both the Republicans and the Democrats are afraid of it. And yet that's what built America. And every other country in the world gets this. And the countries where they're experimenting, like we are, with what's referred to in Europe as neoliberalism, with this idea of, well, let's just throw open the borders, are crashing and burning as well. Look at, you know, what's happening right now in Germany and France, and to some extent in the UK. Because they're saying, well, okay, fine, no borders. So what happens? The German factories are going, why should we do business here in Germany, where we have high labor costs because there's labor unions, and there's a middle class demanding decent pay, when we no longer have to pay import tariffs if we bring something in from Romania where things can be made cheaper, or Bulgaria. And so they're moving their factories out of the country. Now, the flip side of this is there's some factories you can't move out of the country. There are some things that have to be done inside the United States. For example, pouring concrete, building buildings. And so, this front-page story in today's Wall Street Journal, as U.S. debates guest workers, they are here now. If you want to drive down, again, you want to break unions, you want to break the middle class, and these guys want to do this because they think a middle class is a dangerous thing. In the 1770s, we had a middle class, and what did? They overthrew a king. In the 1970s, we had a really strong middle class. What did? Women were out there saying, hey, we want reproductive rights and reproductive freedom. African Americans were saying, hey, we want a place at the table. Gays were saying, hey, we're part of the family. Students were saying, no, we're not going to fight your stinking wars. And the conservatives looked at this and said, this is a country in chaos. This is a dangerous thing. These people have too much money and too much time on their hands. We need to do away with the middle class and go back to just a large class of the working poor. And the second way you do it is you bring in more labor to reduce the price of labor. And they're doing that too. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I miss. It just don't get any better than this.
Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. This is from the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. This article on the occasional article on the labor movement. Union officials complain bitterly that competition from Mexico, and they're talking about people who have green cards, tens of thousands of them, coming up into the United States and working. And then, you know, going back home, guest workers are already here. As the result of the 1986 bill that Ronald Reagan passed, union officials complain bitterly that competition from Mexico is driving down wages, and there's evidence to back them up. Figures compiled by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics indicate wages in concrete work fell 16.5%. Wages in concrete work between 2000 and 2005, from the time Bush came into office to today, they fell 16.5%, despite a soaring demand for workers. Meanwhile, the proportion of cement workers described as, quote, foreign-born Hispanic, end quote, has risen to almost 55% from around 35% in the late 1990s. Statistics suggest many are replacing African Americans whose employment in concrete work declined from 18,000 6 years ago to merely 9,000 today. But see, this isn't about race. This is about nationality. And then they go on to say, and again, quoting the Wall Street Journal here, Joel Millman's piece, illegal immigrant labor drives down wages even more than do legal subsidos. An expanded guest worker program probably would deepen the wage squeeze, says Harvard University immigration economist George Borja. He says, I find a 10% raise in worker supply results in a decline of 3% in wages. Which is, again, this is not rocket science. This is what David Ricardo predicted in 1814. Joe in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Joe, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Wow, it's an amazing subject today because it's like it's increasing so rapidly, the government now becoming more of a monarchy, like you were saying, or taking the rights away from the citizens. And this is almost more like financial slavery, and it no longer has to address the color.
It's not just like financial slavery. It is financial slavery.
It is financial slavery.
I mean, back 30 years ago, I worked my way through college working in radio. I mean, I started in radio at $2.30 an hour, basically minimum wage. And my wife worked her way through college working as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's.
My story I was going to tell you. I worked for Host International subsidiary called Charlie Brown's in 1979. The minimum wage was $1.65 an hour. They had raised it to $1.90 an hour, 25 cents more. Mm-hmm. They called a special meeting at every restaurant, every Host International business in the country. They had to send everybody everywhere to hold special meetings to get all the employees to sign an affidavit that we were willing to not get the increase in minimum wage and stay at $1.65, and they would give us a few more little better things off the menu of their crap food they were going to throw away. But the bartenders who were making $6 an hour were not under that kind of obligation. It was just for the minimum wage. Why? Because they said they owed an obligation of a 4% increase on the next quarter's earnings for Host International.
To their stockholders.
And that is disgusting. And then, now they're making it so they're going to increase the amount of tips that have to be included in your pay.
Yeah. Oregon is one of the few states where tipped workers are still included under the minimum wage law. And conservatives are trying to do away with that here in Oregon as well.
They're going to force your employer to charge 20%.
Oops, I think we may have our phone problem again because Joe just vanished. Let's try Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and see if we can hang on to you, Gary.
Hi, Tom.
We have gremlins in the phones, or Alberto Gonzalez is on to us.
Who knows? You're not a conspiratorist man either.
Well, I suppose. Who killed Kennedy? I mean, it's the ultimate conspiracy.
No. When I think,
anyhow, that's
when
not
I think,
what you called about.
No, I called about our democracy certainly is at a major, major crossroads. I heard the first interview. I disagree with them strongly like you do. I submit this. Inch by inch, the Reagan-Bush presidencies have got a big foothold into changing our culture towards a theocracy. And on the flip side of that, obviously unbridled, unchecked capitalism.
Yeah.
So what does that translate? Are you still there?
I still am. And it's not just a theocracy, Gary. What I'm more concerned about, frankly, is the oligarchy, is the idea of a small group of families, a small group of corporations basically ruling the country. Well, and the reason why conservatives think that this is a good and important thing, and they actually do, they actually, you know, they're true believers in this. Gary just vanished, too. They're true believers in this. The reason why they think that this is a good and positive thing is because they looked, and as I said, they looked at the 1970s, the 1960s and 70s and said, holy cow, you know, when you've got a middle class, I mean, we've had two periods in the United States of a strong middle class, in the 1770s and the 1970s. And both times, both periods, you had people who were talking about revolution, whether it was real revolution in the 1770s, where we overthrew the third king to rule England, or whether it was in the 1970s, social revolution, overthrowing rules like separate but equal, you know, apartheid in the United States, or that women were essentially the property of men, and men could tell them what they could and couldn't do with their body, and you had separate ads in the newspaper, you know, girl wanted, man wanted, or, you know, like that. I mean, it's just, and as people across America in the 1970s stood up and said, hey, wait a minute, we want to have a more egalitarian society. It threatened the conservatives. So they began to fund these huge think tanks to produce all this propaganda to recalibrate the American to think, oh, it's all about the rugged individualist. Forget about the fact that America wasn't built by rugged individuals. It was built by people who did barn raisings together. It's all about community. That's the American way. Community. We need to remind America of it. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be ready.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, they just said, tear it up, throw it away, don't show it to anybody. We don't. Every last piece must be destroyed. This is what former FCC lawyer Adam Kandaev told senior managers at the Federal Communications Commission, according to the Associated Press. Barbara Boxer leaked this. We're talking about the FCC study from a couple of years ago, back in 2004, when there were television stations that were promoting or arguing that they should be able to own even more television stations, you know, big television industry companies, whatever, media monopolies, saying we should be able to own even more TV stations. And so the FCC, under Michael Powell, as the Prometheus Radio Project noted on September 15th, former FCC Chairman Michael Powell made many high-sounding pronouncements about the need for media policy to be rooted in empirical evidence. He also attempted to separate out the issue of media consolidation from localism, claiming that most of the millions of comments to the commission stem from the concern of local content, not a concern about concentration of ownership into fewer hands. In other words, what they're saying is, what the FCC was saying is, what we're concerned about is whether or not TV stations are carrying local news. You know, the news at six kind of thing. And if they're doing that, it doesn't matter who owns them. That was the position of the Republicans and Michael Powell, the guy who was made chairman of the FCC as a gift to his dad, Colin, for joining the Bush administration, bringing some of his credibility to George W., who had been a deserter during the Vietnam War. Yes, I use that word advisedly. You're AWOL for the first 30 days. On the 31st day, you become a deserter. He was gone for almost a year. In any case, Michael Powell saying, doesn't make any difference. And then he ordered a study to prove that what he was saying was right. And they did the study, and they discovered when they did the study that locally owned TV stations tended to have 5.5 more minutes of local news in a 30-minute newscast than stations with non-local ownership. That's 33 hours of local news a year. And so instead of telling us about it, or instead of acting on it, Michael Powell ordered, that the study be destroyed, every last copy. And somebody leaked this thing to Barbara Boxer, and she brought it up when FCC Chair Republican Kevin Martin was being questioned for his renomination hearing, and he said, I don't know about it. I don't know, I'm a mushroom here. So, which leads us to our activism alert for the day. Here's what you can do. Contact the FCC and encourage the Inspector General to conduct an investigation into the suppression of the media ownership report. The FCC Office of the Inspector General, hotline at fcc.gov is their email. Their phone number is 202-418-9663. 0470. I'll give that to you again in just a minute if you need to grab a pen. This is the FCC's Office of the Inspector General. Their email address, hotline at FCC.gov. Their telephone number, 202-418-0470. And say, we would like to see an investigation into why this media ownership report was suppressed and what it said. You can also contact your local member of Congress and let them know. Now, back to these economic issues that we were talking about and how it affects the political issue of, for example, torture. In fact, I'm going to bring all this around here for you. But let's start with the economics, because it really does lead to things like Bush sanctioning torture. The destruction of the American middle class, the disenfranchisement of Americans right across the board by promoting the Tom Friedman, George W. Bush, really Ronald Reagan, by promoting the world is flat view, by promoting policies based in it. Corporate free trade. It's expensive trade for all the rest of us because we're paying for the infrastructure on which corporations are operating. We're paying for the court system. We're paying for the contract law. We're paying for the legislatures that produce those laws. We're paying for the jails that hold people like Ken Lay. If the Bush family doesn't get you first, right? The one guy who could have spilled the beans about George Bush and Gray Davis and the whole thing and just happens to die as soon as he starts plea bargaining with a prosecutor. Terrible coincidence. Yeah, I'm sure it probably is a coincidence. I'm sure it is. Very fortuitous. Just like Osama bin Laden's brother. Right after he bails out George W. Bush's oil company, or Busto oil company. Or no, Harkin. He bailed out Harkin oil company. A year or so later, he dies in a plane crash in Texas. It's a coincidence. That really is. In any case, these guys working to destroy the middle class in America, working ultimately to destroy democracy in America and replace it with an oligarchy of a ruling few, they're doing it not because they're evil people, not because they're crazy. I mean, you could describe their actions as evil if you're in the middle class. Look at the impact. I mean, the consequences are terrible. People suffer. People die as a consequence of this. But they don't think of themselves as evil people. They think of themselves as patriots. They think of themselves as people who love America. The difference between their worldview and that of Thomas Jefferson and you or me is that Jefferson, when he looked at the chaos of the 1770s and the 1780s and the 1790s, and even the French Revolution, I mean, it was about the French Revolution that he wrote, every now and then the Tree of Liberty needs to be sprinkled with the blood of patriots. When he looked at social chaos, he thought, this is a good thing because it will ultimately bring about positive change and it will become homeostatic. In fact, Jefferson made the argument that if you give the majority of the people the majority of the power, yes, they will make mistakes. See, the big fear is that the conservatives are always promoting with this phony email that's going around from this Scottish academician and economist from the 19th century. And it is phonied up. I mean, it's the guy was real, but the what he said was not. That if you give the people absolute power, they'll simply vote to give all the money to themselves. Well, where did the money come from? Well, themselves. Or they'll vote to give all the money from the rich people to themselves. Well, that really scares the conservatives, and they think that it's true. And in fact, it's not. Well, yeah, we had a top marginal tax rate of 90%, but that was advocated by the Republican President Eisenhower. In any case, Jefferson's point about democracy is that if you give the majority of the power to the majority of the people, yes, they will make mistakes, and because they will be the ones who suffer the consequences of those mistakes, they will also correct them quickly. Democracy becomes a rapidly self-regulating, self-correcting mechanism. Whereas if you have power, political power, in the hands of a very small elite, a very few, then you have a system that corrects itself very slowly, very often over generations, sometimes over centuries, sometimes over millennia. I mean, look at how long the kings ruled China and Japan. Look at how long the emperors of Japan. Look at how long the kings and the feudal lords ruled Europe. The Mayan and Aztec civilizations in Central and South America. They were not rapidly correcting, self-correcting systems. Jefferson was right. But these guys are afraid of that. They really are. From the early American conservatives like John Adams, who referred to people like you and me as the rabble, and said, well, you know, give them the appearance of democracy, but don't let them elect their senators. You know, the people couldn't vote for the United States Senate until 1913 when the 17th Amendment was passed. From John Adams to today, conservatives look at social ferment and they go, uh-oh. And so what's happening around the world as a consequence of this? It's really interesting. You see this absolute contrast. I mean, there is an absolute and complete contrast happening from what's going on in the formerly fairly progressive countries like Germany and France and England, who are swinging to the right because they're drinking the Ronald Reagan Kool-Aid, to countries like Chile and Argentina and Bolivia and Ecuador and Peru and Brazil and Venezuela and Mexico, who are moving to the left because they've seen the consequences of this. In fact, I'll give you some details on that right after the break. It's absolutely fascinating to see how this is shaking out and what it means for the future of America. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Take a deep breath. Feel like you're choking.
Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, on the moving to the right, here's the date. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. It's really interesting because they're juxtaposed. I mean, they're right next to each other. Europe and the Americas under the World Watch column, the Wall Street Journal today. Both Associated Press stories. The first one, Schwerin, Germany. Is the dateline, the city of Schwerin. A far-right party won seats yesterday in a regional parliament in a formerly communist East Germany, exploiting discontent in the region with the country's highest unemployment rate. The National Democratic Party, which is essentially the reinvention of something close to being a Nazi party, I mean, they're very, very right-wing, won 7.3% of the vote in Mecklenburg, a rural region next to the Polish border that includes Ms. Merkel's home constituency, up from less than 1% in the previous state vote. And because they have proportional representation there, you get 7% of the vote, you get 7% of the seats in parliament. Right? Mainstream parties had called on voters to cast their ballot for anyone except the National Democratic Party. Known by its initials NDP, the party is a fringe player at the national level, where its affinities with Adolf Hitler's Nazis deters the vast majority of voters. The party has gained a foothold in the economically struggling East, where in 2004 it won seats in the legislature in the state of Saxony by getting 9.2% of the local vote. Yesterday's results in Mecklenburg and Berlin were doubly worrying for Germany's dominant party, Mrs. Merkel's conservatives and her coalition partner in the current federal government, the Social Democrats, as well as the strong showing for the NPD, neither of the big parties scored much above 30% in either election. So what's happening is in Germany, where they have been drinking the Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, free trade, Tom Friedman Kool-Aid, and joined the European Union and said, okay, we're going to take down all these barriers to trade so that the big German corporations can move their factories out of Germany and into Bulgaria where labor is cheaper and bring the goods back into Germany without having to pay a tariff on the way in and sell them in Germany to the Germans who used to have a good strong middle class. In Germany, as the middle class is being hollowed out, people are responding by turning to the Reich. As many are in the United States, This is something that I think, you know, a lot of Democrats don't get. You know, they're sitting, what's the matter with Kansas? They're sitting around, they're looking at areas that are economically distressed and trying to figure out why these people are voting for people like Reagan and Bush. It's because they're afraid. They're economically afraid. They know that, you know, one illness and they're toast. If they lose their paycheck, they lose their home. They're afraid. And so when people are afraid, they very often turn to authority figures. And Reagan and Bush and Bush, particularly the most recent Bush, have presented themselves as authority figures. Don't worry, we'll take care of you. We're not safe enough yet, but we're getting safer, but we still have a ways to go. We gotta be afraid of those terrorists. We gotta be tough. Gotta kick them upside the head. We gotta torture them. We're tough guys. It's the behavior of fascists. And it's what people will turn to if they're afraid. On the other hand, you look across Central and South America where they saw the actual fascists since World War II. Pinochet and others. Where they saw the right destroying people. You say in Mexico, they saw the rebellions down in the south. In Honduras and in Nicaragua, throughout that region, they saw the death squads that came when John Negroponte came into that area. And they've said, enough. We don't want it. And so, for example, in Mexico, where there's substantial evidence that the vote was stolen by the right-wing party of Vicente Fox and now soon-to-be President Calderon. This, the story right next to the story about how the Reich is rising in Germany as their economy is decimated by these so-called free trade policies. In Mexico City, here, López Obrador to run parallel government as Mexican opposition. Hundreds of thousands of supporters of leftist Andrés Manuel López Obrador elected him the leader Saturday of a parallel government opposed to President-elect Felipe Calderón's administration. This is what the Democrats should do in the United States if the Republicans steal another election. And I say if advisedly, I should say probably when. The symbolic vote, a show of hands in the packed Zocalo Plaza, was the latest development in Mexico's nearly three-month electoral dispute. Mr. López Obrador claims fraud and illegal government spending were responsible for Calderón's victory by fewer than 234,000 votes. Supporters of Mr. López Obrador said they would travel the country to spread his message of helping the poor and opposing the elite. He will be sworn into his new post on November 20th. Mr. Calderón will be inaugurated December 1st. Delegates at Saturday's convention also agreed to support the formation of a progressive front to replace the former coalition of leftist parties that backed Mr. López Obrador in the national election. John Kerry, are you listening? Or whoever's going to be the next John Kerry. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Just an old truth teller, I'm your candid friend. I'm not some daydream seller, I do not pretend.
And welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news 34 minutes past the hour. Carl Levin on Face the Nation.
I do believe that we've got to stay with the position that protects American troops, that protects American values, and avoids handing our enemy, the terrorists, the weapon which they want more than anything else, probably, which is that America are hypocrites, that America mistreats prisoners. That plays into their hands. That's the propaganda tool that they want, and we should not hand it to them. And I hope the Senate will stand with the Armed Services Committee and not with the unilateralist administration, which we now have.
Yeah. So, I have to say, and this is, and the right-wingers are pounded on this, the right-wing talk show hosts. You got to beat them up. You got to torture them. You got to kill them. You got to find them. You got to punch them in the face. Right? This whole kind of pseudo-testosterone strutty thing. It's all about dealing with the fear that people have that comes out of their economic disenfranchisement in the United States, and also by economically disenfranchising people in the United States, by wiping out the middle class. When Ronald Reagan came into office, 25% of the American workforce was unionized. That meant half of the American workforce, because for every union job, there's another one similar to it because they provide the local floor for employment. Half of the American workforce could raise their kids, had fully paid health insurance, had a pension for a good, safe retirement. Half of the American workforce when Reagan came into office. Today, 7%. 26 years of warfare, unrelenting warfare against the American middle class. Today, 7% of the American workforce, the non-governmental workforce, is unionized. It's a disaster for the American middle class. And yet, from the conservative point of view, it's a wonderful thing. Because people are too busy to go out in the streets. They're working two and three jobs. They don't have the leisure time to go out in the streets. They don't have the leisure time to even follow the news. They just want a little entertainment, a bottle of beer, and let me get on with the day because I got to get back to work at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. And their kids are not speaking out in school because they're scared to death they might get kicked out of that school and be stuck with a $30,000 debt and not even get a degree for it. You get it? The destruction of the American middle class and the rise of the Reich in the United States are all part of the same thing. And what is truly dangerous about it is that it's being done by people who really and truly believe that it's the right thing for America. They agree with John Adams, our first conservative president, that the rabble should not have power, not have political power. That you need to keep people quiet, that people need to know their place, that there need to be classes and orders in society. There's the ruling class and there's the ruled. And that's just the natural order of things in their mind. They're fundamentally anti-democratic, anti-democracy. And that worldview, that authoritarian worldview, is not an evidence-based worldview. For example, the fact that the most effective way to interrogate people, the most effective way, and the CIA knows, I think they've been saying this for years, the most effective way to get information from people is to induce the Stockholm Syndrome in them, where they identify with those who are holding them. It's not about, here, have some cookies, please like me. That's not how you do it. It's a very, very sophisticated system. But it's done all the time. Deprogrammers do it. I have a friend who used to deprogram people from cults, Hilly Zeitlin. He used to work with Ted Patrick. And there is a science to it, to breaking a person's identification with who they used to identify with the jihad, with the cult leader, with whatever it may be, and establishing a new identity with you. And this is the effective way to get intelligence, not to waterboard people. You waterboard people and they'll tell you anything. More often than not, it's the wrong thing. John McCain said, when he was tortured by the Vietnamese, they wanted the names of American officers who were spies. He gave them the names of the offensive line of the Green Bay Packers. For 2 years, they're running around looking for these guys. Yes, I'll tell you anything. It may or may not be accurate. Or I'll tell you what you want to hear. Here's John McCain on this.
This is a matter of conscience, an American conscience. Are we going to be like the enemy, or are we going to be the United States of America? There's a war that we are losing in some ways, as General Powell pointed out, and that's our standing in the world because of our treatment at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, etc. We have to keep the moral high ground.
1-866-440-8466, our phone number. Sean in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. Hey, Sean.
To talk about the aspect of torture, I really do believe that there's something even sort of darker brewing here. This isn't merely the interrogation of, you know, foreign terrorist suspects. Really, this is ultimately going to lead to civil rights breakdown here in our country.
Oh, it could be the interrogation of you and me. I mean, this
exactly.
They took Jose Padilla, who is an American citizen, and banished him.
Yeah,
And as well as the other, there's another guy, I forget his name, it wasn't Ramzi Youssef, it was somebody, but two American citizens, they banished them. And yeah, I mean, we talked last week on the program, we had Greg Palestine, where he was busted for taking pictures of the FEMA trailers down there, because FEMA's now part of Homeland Security, so it's a national security infrastructure. And, you know, for the BBC, taking pictures of FEMA trailers, he's busted for this. He could have, under the new Bush rules, simply vanished. Never had an opportunity to call his lawyer. Never had access to his lawyer. He could have been held in detention at the concentration camp in Guantanamo Bay. He could have, you know, without representation, he could have been subject to a trial that he didn't attend, where evidence was given by people that he couldn't challenge and he didn't hear, and sentenced to death and be put to death without ever even knowing what the charges were against him and without even ever even making a phone call.
Oh, yeah, and I agree. And the thing is one aspect of this that I think that no one has really talked about yet is the fact that the dialogue on the right is already there. Quite often, to sort of keep attuned to what they're saying, I'll tune into a Rush Limbaugh or Mike Savage or an Ann Coulter or a Laura Ingraham, and it's there. They're already calling anybody who disagrees with them traitors, complicit with terrorism. And the dialogue is already set. And it's going to eventually hit the mainstream. Well, I think it already has, where basically they're going. And
first, they came for the terrorists.
And if you don't agree with them, that's the problem. I mean, people really have to wake up and start getting worried and energized by this.
Yes.
Because it's going to, I think, bite us in the butt if this keeps going. Because
I think it already is, Sean.
Yeah, and the dialogue is, like I said, it's there. You know, it may not be as pleasant as listening to NPR, but sometimes you have to tune in and hear these.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It is there, and they are out there, and they're saying it already. And when Pastor Niemöller, in his famous, you know, first they came for the communists, but I was not a communist, and so I did not object. And then they came for the Jews, and I wasn't a Jew, and I didn't object. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, and I didn't object. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then finally they came for me, and there was no one left. He started out, first they came for the communists, because the guy, Martin van der Lubbe, this 28-year-old Dutchman who set on fire the Reichstaggebouw, the parliament building in Germany, the equivalent of setting on fire the capital of the United States of America. This was Germany's 9/11. In February 28th, as I recall, of 1933, when Martin van der Lubbe did that, he was a self-identified communist. And so in Germany in the 1930s, to say we're going to lock up the communists was identical in terms of public reaction to in the United States today saying we're going to lock up the terrorists who did 9/11. Think about it. First they came for the terrorists. And in the midst of it, the same economic warfare that was being waged in Germany. Michael in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hey, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know you were talking about David Ricardo and, you know, his relevance now in terms of protecting your economy with tariffs and things like that. But, I try to follow the labor movement as closely as possible. And to me, with something, you know, an older economist and philosopher that's even more relevant, I mean, it's been consistently relevant for the last, you know, 100 years, you know, been Karl Marx. You know, the more and more I follow things, it just seems to me it's just, you know, it's just blatant class warfare.
Yeah,
you know,
Marx, I'm assuming you're talking about Das Kapital. That's his primary work on the topic. I mean, the Communist Manifesto that he co-authored with Engels goes off on a tangent. But you know, I will give you half of that. Marx, in my opinion, correctly diagnosed the problems of capitalism. His solution doesn't work. I was in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union. I was in East Germany when it was East Germany. And it was hell. You know, Marx's solution didn't work, but his diagnosis was correct. And I think that Franklin Roosevelt's solution did work, which is making the government the employer of last resort, but only of last resort.
I think it pretty much, it depends. You know, there's a lot of people who, if you speak to, there is still, you know, a decent amount of, you know, socialist people and, you know, movements and things like that. And most people you speak to do not, you know, up to a certain, they support the Soviet Union up to a certain point, and then it kind of degenerates into, you know, what they call a capitalist system in terms of government becomes an employer, you know, and reaping some benefits.
But what you're identifying, Michael, is the fact that most of us who are who are suggesting that we should have capitalism regulated in the way that, in the ways that Franklin Roosevelt advocated regulating it, are not the left. You know, the left are the folks who are saying, yeah, Karl Marx was right in his diagnosis and in his prescription, and the government should own the means of production and distribution. And I'm not saying that, and I think most Americans aren't saying that. So, you know, the left is gone. We are the middle, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hold on to your dreams, my friends.
Hold on to your dreams. Hey, hold on to your dreams.
It's talk radio for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 9 minutes before the hour, or will be in about 15 seconds for those of you who pay such careful attention. Welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room or participate in our message boards, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat while the program is live, noon to 3 Eastern time, 9 to noon Pacific time. And when the program isn't live, even when the program isn't live, there's usually people hanging out in the chat room. And you can also participate in our message boards and blog also right over there at tomhartman.com and get the whole thing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
First, I want to say something to you.
Okay.
You don't know how much I truly appreciate your show and your knowledge.
Well, thank you, Armin.
And I feel like I'm really getting the education that I should be getting that I really didn't get when I should have been getting it.
You mean like
but now I'm getting it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And hopefully it's entertaining as well. So, but
well, it's addictive.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Well, that's good. So that's not what you that's not what you called about, though. You had a point you wanted to make, Armin.
Well, because you're the great articulator. You're much more polished than me. I'm learning. I got a lot of good ideas and a lot of good thoughts, but you're the pro here, so I give it to you. An interesting point that explains a lot is if you look at these people that profess to believe in the free market system and you really follow the money and who they're connected with, and most of them basically are part of the top 20% and economically, and that top 20% is ruled by about the top 1%. In this country and in the world, and that top 1% that supposedly believes in a free market and free enterprise have monopolized the creation of the money system to where they create it, they do, exclusively by their control out of thin air. They loan it to the rest of us to use, and they also own everything that ultimately the money stops at and benefits from in all the corporations.
Yeah, you're talking about the Fed?
Well, I'm talking about the Fed and the wealthy billionaires that are all part of that, really.
Yeah. Well, let me step off on that with a rant, Armin, and thank you for the point in making it. The federal debt right now, the federal debt right at this moment, $8,368,594,433,000. Whoops, it went up to $597 million. $1,615.47. Okay, the federal debt. The interest payments on that debt this year, estimated interest payment on the debt this year, to date. Now, this isn't for the entire year. This is as of September 18th. And this is the U.S. debt clock. The estimated interest payment on that is so far this year. Now, last year it was $321,566,000,000. This year, so far, it's $14,573.08. What does that mean? That means that the average citizen this year so far has paid $851.77 in interest on the debt. That's without paying down the debt. A family of four this year so far has paid $3,407.08 in interest on the money that was largely borrowed by Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. And why did they borrow all this money? Two reasons. Number one, starve the beast. Throw the government into debt so that, three reasons. Number one, throw the government into debt so that they can eventually say, you know, we're so far in debt, we just can't afford this Medicare anymore. We can't afford Social Security. We have to privatize it. Do away with what these guys refer to as socialism. Undo the New Deal. This is what they're all about, is undoing the New Deal. All of Roosevelt's programs, from unemployment insurance to old age retirement, Social Security, to the ability to unionize, all of those programs that Roosevelt passed, these guys want to undo. As Limbaugh says,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
So number one, starve the beast. Number two, that $3,407.08 that a family of four so far has paid is going into the hands of the people who own the treasuries. George W. Bush, born with a trust fund in the millions of dollars in treasuries. It's the very wealthy in America who are we're paying interest to them, guaranteed income, and to China and whatnot. And so, you know, here it is, building this thing. And number three, by running up this debt, Reagan and Bush Jr. were able to make the economy look better than it was, because it's just like if you go out and you get a mortgage on your house and you get a second mortgage for another $20,000 and you spend that $20,000, you can make it look like you're living large, or an extra $100,000 or whatever. You can make it look like you're living large, even though you're not. And that is the disaster of the whole thing. I mean, that is the real disaster of the whole thing. That this was done for purely political purposes. For number one, starve the beast and destroy the liberal reforms of Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. And number two, to try and make things look good so that these guys could get and keep political power. That's what's wrong with it. Tomorrow, I'll be challenging Ann Hendershot on our new book, The Politics of Abortion. Ryan Sager will be here on how the Republican Party is self-destructing. And Tuesday's Talk Like a Pirate Day. Can't quite do it myself. We'll be answering your calls with Ahoy, matey! And keep it in mind, a pirate can tell any tale of swashbuckling as long as it's 51% true. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.